This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hello everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 370 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, holy moly, I'm sharing with you an interview that I'm quite excited about, very proud of, and incredibly honored to present. A conversation with Patty Boyd, who has been a witness and a participant in many key moments of music history. Now, Patty, as you know, was previously married to George Harrison and Eric Clapton. She was the subject of songs like Something, Layla, Wonderful Tonight, and more. And Patty is a photographer and artist as well, who's released a brand new book, My Life in Pictures, which is exactly that, her life in photographs, which includes many elements and images that music fans will enjoy. It's an absolutely wonderful book. Patty Boyd, My Life in Pictures, available wherever you get your music books, or signed copies are available direct from pattyboyd.co.uk. Now today, Patty and I discuss all sorts of topics. Meeting George, getting wrapped up in the Beatles world, sharing music and records with George, watching Frank Sinatra record My Way, meeting Elvis, her recollection on key Beatles moments like the passing of Brian Epstein, or the various breakups of the band. We also talk about Yoko in the studio, the Beatles receiving offers to reform, the original Derek and the Dominoes cover painting, and lots more. And by the way, there's an extended version of this interview up at patreon.com/vinylguide. So if you're a show patron, you could hear more of this conversation up there. Plus, it's commercial free. Plus, it helps support the show. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And finally, if you're new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, welcome to the show. Have a nice comfy seat, grab a beer out of the fridge, and we ask that you subscribe or follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. It's free, it's easy, you get some 350-plus episodes and interviews, including Kenny Jones of The Who, The Faces, both small and regular, episode 339, Leland Sklar of Jackson Browne, James Taylor, Phil Collins, and more, episode 362, Robbie Krieger of The Doors, episode 306, Peter Frampton, episode 300, The Business of Beatles Vinyl with Andrew from Parlagram Auctions, episode 258, Andy Partridge of XTC, episode 255, Guy Pratt of Pink Floyd and More, episode 237, Robert Trujillo of Metallica, episode 230, The Story of the Beatles Butcher Cover, episode 222, and lots more. Subscribe or follow the Vinyl Guide podcast for free and enjoy all the episodes and interviews anytime. And with the upfronts done, let's get into our conversation with Patty Boyd on her life in pictures and music.
Patty Boyd, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here. So early for you and halfway through the day for me.
Well, I'm glad you caught me on this end of the world. Patty, I've really enjoyed this book, My Life in Pictures, as well as your other book, Wonderful Tonight or Wonderful Today, depending on where you're at in the world. I've always seen photos of you with a camera around and always wondered what happened to those photographs. And now I know.
Yes.
Were you shy about sharing your photos in the past?
I think there was a time at the beginning I was rather shy. I tell you what it was. I was shy and I was insecure that maybe I would be criticized for the wrong reasons, you know? And plus, I wasn't sure if my photographs were good enough for anyone to see.
Mm. Because you always spent so much time on one end of the camera. Was there any sort of insight that you brought? I mean, obviously there was some sort of insight from being on one side of the camera to being able to be on the other, yeah?
Yes. I find it very helpful for people I'm photographing because you see, I remember how it was, how I felt in front of a camera. And I imagine everyone will feel the same way, slightly nervous and not sure if they've got the right face or the right position. And I think as a model, I can be very helpful to people.
Hmm. Help them relax. You understand them.
Definitely help them relax. It's essential to do that. Mm-hmm. You don't want somebody looking very nervous, you know, As if they've been caught in the spotlight.
But those are photos that they know you may be taking, they may be posing for. But there's a lot of other photos where you're just capturing a moment that maybe someone doesn't even recognize you're capturing.
Yes, I think sometimes those are the best because people are totally relaxed. And it's normally in a situation where they're enjoying whatever they're talking about or whatever they're doing. And so I'm capturing them in a moment of not really repose, but full of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, living. Just
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, you've collected negatives for, you know, several decades now. Was it painful at all to revisit some of those memories?
No, it was really quite a surprise because I'd forgotten that I had taken quite so many photographs. And, you know, once you take them, you file them away. You never really re-look at them unless for a situation like trying to put a book together. And so it was actually quite fun. And plus, I had lots of Polaroids as well as old prints that I had done because I used to process and print my own photographs. And it was, you know, it was a lovely thing to do, actually. But, you know, the book is also comprised of photographs that the editor, he did his own research and he went out to and asked many photographers if they have photographs that they took of me in the 70s when I was modelling. And so there are a lot of photos in the book that I've never seen before. So that's quite nice.
When did you get that first camera that you started to take pictures in earnest?
Probably when I was 18. Mm-hmm. And so I would take my camera around to various photographers that I was working with, and they would all help me a bit here and there.
And you still have some of those negatives. You've been able to mine some of those negatives for the book.
Some of them, but you know, I'm actually quite naughty in as much as if I think something doesn't work or I don't really like it, I tend to bin them, which is an absolute mistake. So when I met up with my assistant, he was furious with me for throwing anything away.
You never realize when one of those will be a bit of history.
No, just don't know.
Well, this is, again, it's an amazing book, and your other book is equally fascinating as well. I was doing a bit of a count. I could think of 8 famous songs that were written specifically about you. Is that the number 8?
Well, no, it could be about that. Yes, it could, because Eric did, in fact, write quite a few songs about me or for me, not just the ones that we all recognize, like Layla and Wonderful Tonight. Those are the classics. Mm-hmm. Then there are lots of others that he wrote, like Old Love. This is clearly when he and I were splitting up. But, it doesn't make it any less a beautiful song because he's such a talented musician.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of another person inspiring that many well-known songs, love songs?
I must admit to you that I haven't really looked into it, but maybe I should. I don't know. Have you?
No, I haven't. That's why I'm wondering, with the exception of some sort of maybe religious leader, I think you're top of the list for humans.
Wow, I hadn't thought about that. What about muses who've been painted by other painters?
Okay, like who?
Oh, yeah, like who exactly? Well, I know there was some Pre-Raphaelite artists like Frederick Leighton, who used in the 30s, 20s, mm-hmm. okay. used to use a model or two models were favorites. But maybe, I mean, difficult, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah, well, you have inspired quite a bit of art, music, photography, paintings even. But real quick, let's go back to the early days. You met George on a movie set. Yeah, Hard Day's Night. Was that 63, 64?
I'd met him in 63. Mm-hmm. When they had just started making A Hard Day's Night. I think that was in January or February of 63.
Okay. How familiar were you with the Beatles when you had met George?
I was just aware that they were a really good band and their music was great. And I loved Please, Please Me. And I really thought no more about them. And then when I was going to be in this movie, I had no idea that it was a movie with the Beatles. I thought when I went for the interview that it was for a commercial, TV commercial, for a crisp company. And it wasn't. It was the same director that had directed me in the commercial who was directing the Beatles film, Dick Lester. And so he cast me as a schoolgirl. And I panicked because I just had never really thought and didn't want to be an actress. I thought being a model was fine. I really wasn't interested in going into acting. So when my agent said I'd got a part in the Beatles film, I panicked. And I said, oh, no, I don't think I can do this. They've got the wrong person, I think. And she said, no, they do want you. And so she said, don't worry, you've only got to say one word. Hey, I could do that.
And that one word was?
Prisoners. Prisoners.
So there was that that scene with you and George. Was that improvised at the time, or was that written into the script?
No, it was all in the script.
Oh, okay.
I think that an awful lot, actually, on reflection, I think there's an awful lot of improvisation in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
No, I must say it was great fun being on a train for 5 hours, 6 hours with the Beatles, turtling down to Cornwall and back and just hanging out and listening to them. I mean, I'd never really met anyone from Liverpool before. And I thought they were hilarious. They were so funny. Plus, I didn't really understand everything they were saying. They almost speak a different language.
Mm.
But they were great fun and they were really charming. And it was great, wonderful for me.
I imagine so. And you tell the story of the meeting, the courtship in the book Wonderful Tonight. There's a part in there where George famously asked Brian Epstein if it was okay for him to marry you and was happy when Brian approved. So a lot of decisions of the Beatles used to go through Brian Epstein.
Well, I think, the thing is that George had to go and find out when they weren't touring and when they weren't in the studio. So what dates were free for us to get married? It wasn't actually to ask his permission.
Okay.
As I think some people believe.
Okay. It was more just to clear the schedule and find out when would be an appropriate time.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. Mm. And this period of Beatles, I mean, it must have been fascinating to be part of, and especially watching them go through the evolution of their music at this point. Do you have any recollections of witnessing the evolution, the big ideas coming that they had around that time?
Well, it was very rare for me or any of the other girlfriends, wives, to be invited to the studio when they mm-hmm. were recording. Except I remember I went on two occasions. One was to be a sort of backup singer with them all singing Happy Birthday. Oh, no, that was fun. It was also slightly nerve-wracking because I've never, ever thought of myself as someone with a nice singing voice at all. But it didn't seem to matter. And I can't remember what the other one was. I think just being in the background when they were creating noise and laughter, Yellow Submarine, that's what it was. So I was, when they were recording that, it was fun.
Oh, okay. So you sang backups on Yellow Submarine and Today's Your Birthday?
Not really singing backups. No, only singing backups on Happy Birthday.
Okay.
But on Yellow Submarine, I had to laugh and make a bit of a noise as if there were a party going on.
Did you and George talk a lot about music? Did you share a lot of music together?
George was an amazing teacher. He taught me a lot about music. He introduced me to a lot of musicians, not just in person, but their music.
Mm-hmm.
And, I really learned everything from George.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys have a big record collection at the house?
Yeah, we did. Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And the turntable was constantly going. Do you remember a lot of the records that you and George kept gravitating towards?
Well, yeah, I mean, we loved all the Motown songs and Detroit all the music that came out of Detroit. And mainly American singers, I have to say. Mainly.
I saw in your book where there were some meetings, or at least one meeting with Elvis and Frank Sinatra. Did George ever get starstruck by anyone?
Yes, he was. Certainly he was. And it was rather adorable to see, because he had no idea how they saw him. Where he would look at, you know, somebody like Elvis, and in an adoring, or Frank, in such an adoring, amazing way, not knowing that they would be looking at him with the same thoughts of how nice it was to meet him. So it was, you know, really interesting. George loved, he was overwhelmed by meeting Elvis, and the same with Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. We were lucky enough to be invited to see Frank record when we were in LA for a while. And we went up to the studio and up in the control room. And then you look through the window and see where there was a full orchestra playing, rehearsing and practicing. And we met Frank, and it was just, you know, very exciting. And he was very pleased to meet George. And George was just thrilled to meet him. And then he went downstairs into the studio and sang My Way. And it was unbelievable. It was so extraordinary and beautiful. And then he came back up to the control room to hear what went down. And as far as I was concerned, that was the first take. I mean, I know when the Beatles record, they record it again and again and again, mm-hmm. endless takes. But with Frank, he did it, he sang it, he came up, listened and said, "That's it, let's go and have a drink." And I went away thinking, my God, that was incredible. He did it in one take. But maybe before we arrived, he could have been done several other takes before.
Yeah.
I don't.
Do you remember, okay, when being invited to the studio, was it just to be a witness? Was it because George was in town, but Frank wanted him there?
Yeah, it was because George was in town. And I think Frank wanted to meet him out of curiosity, really. It must have been curiosity, because he didn't afterwards behave as if he wanted to be his friend or know anything about him. Because we went to this big sort of like hotel where there was a room for Frank with this enormous table, and all Frank's guys sat around, and George automatically thought that he should sit next to Frank and have a little chat. But he was moved along. Frank had who he wanted to sit next to him, and I was sitting next to somebody from New York, and I don't know. They all had different bottles of alcohol in front of them. So the waiters knew what they wanted to drink.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess contrast that with meeting Elvis. I believe Elvis watched a movie with you guys. Not even, there was a great memory of that, I seem to recall.
Yes, sweetie. You got it slightly wrong. It was when Eric and I were in Memphis. We were invited to meet Elvis. But George and I had met him when he was playing Madison Square Garden.
Oh, okay.
And before he went on stage, somebody approached us. We were sitting in our seats, and somebody approached us and said, "Elvis wants to meet you." Like, oh, my God, this is too exciting. So anyway, we went down to his dressing room, and as luck would have it, he's in the loo, right? So he came out and he looked absolutely magnificent, because he's wearing that great, fabulous white suit. And to me, in my young mind, he was like so enormous. He was about 10 foot tall and just beautiful, beyond beautiful. And we said hello to him, and then we were ushered back to our seats.
Okay. So that was a good memory. When George was writing a song like Something, would he share that with you through the process, or did he show you only the end result?
Only the end, but not the complete end. The end, as far as he had recorded, you know, a first track of it, mm-hmm. in the studio the night before. So the next morning he played it for me on the cassette machine. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I heard it. And he said he'd written it for me, and I was just so thrilled. And then, of course, they went to the studio the next day, and then they added all the other things that go on top.
Mm-hmm.
until it was finished and ready.
Okay. So he would share sometimes demos with you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, nearly all the demos that the Beatles did in the studio, I'd hear them the next day. So they were quite familiar to me by the time they came out.
Okay. So, for example, the Escher demos for the White Album that were done at your house, I believe. You were hearing them almost in real time, the evening that they, maybe not while they were being recorded, but while they were reviewing it.
Yeah, well, exactly. While they were working on them, I was privy to hear them working. Mm-hmm. And, and then when they went into the studio, George would play me the tapes the next day.
Would they ask for feedback or information or just checking the reaction?
I don't think they held me in such high regard as far as, music is concerned. You know, that's their area of expertise and certainly not mine. I think they just, George was happy with whatever they had recorded, whichever track it was. And so, wanting to share the happiness and joy with me, which was I loved. And, I, of course, loved everything they did.
So around this time, there was a character that went by the name of Magic Alex. Mm-hmm. And over time, he's come to be recognized as a bit of an extreme for some of the folks that the Beatles were hanging around with at the time. And he seems to have really enjoyed the trust of the Beatles. What are your recollections of Magic Alex?
Well, at first, I was totally taken in by him. I thought there was something quite exotic about him. He totally believed in everything he did and said. And it was fascinating to see how John was just blown away by him. John was ready to believe anything that Alex said. And Alex would say, oh, I think that, I'm going to invent a wallpaper that is so thin, but it's like, music. You can play music through it. So you can walk into a room, the whole room would be full of music, emanating from the walls. Said that he could do almost anything, which is why I think John named him Magic Alex, because he could do just about anything, John believed.
Yeah.
Don't know if really anything that he promised that he could create actually turned into reality. He had great ideas, but putting them all together, I think, proved a little difficult.
Do you recall when people started to think maybe Magic Alex wasn't the guy for the job, is building the studio?
Yes, absolutely. But these words were spoken out of John's earshot, because John thought he was marvelous. And he did actually build a studio in Apple, in the Apple offices. And I don't know if it was 100% fantastic or whether he did it completely on his own or had help from other engineers. Hmm. I'm sure he had help.
I believe it was you who originally found the Maharishi, the session that was in London where you and the Beatles originally met the Maharishi. Is that correct?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey, everyone. I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with 2 Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VinylGuide10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VinylGuide10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. I believe it was you who originally found the Maharishi, the session that was in London where you and the Beatles originally met the Maharishi. Is that correct?
Sort of. Mm-hmm. When the Beatles were on tour in Australia, I saw an advertisement in one of the papers saying if anybody is interested at all in learning transcendental meditation, to go to this address in London, which I did. I went with a girlfriend and we learned about transcendental meditation. And then the Beatles came back from Australia and I told George all about, you know, this form of meditation, and he was really interested. And then luck would have it, Paul phoned the next week, and said, there's this guy, Maharishi, coming to London, and he's going to give a talk at the Hilton Hotel. Let's all go. So, of course, when one of the Beatles did something, we all did it. So off we all went to listen to him, and everybody was suitably impressed. He's very charismatic and invited us all to go to Wales, another part of England, where he could give them further instruction.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This was the fateful day, the next day, when we heard that Brian Epstein had died.
Tell me your recollection of that moment when the Beatles found out about Brian Epstein. Oh,
it was so horrific. I mean, they looked traumatized that their best friend had suddenly gone, because he was not only their best friend, he was their manager, he was their guide, and he was their best friend. You know, I mean, he was just, he meant a lot to all of them. And to think that they were now orphans, really, left on their own with no one to look after them or guide them. And they're musicians, they're not business people. So the whole concept of now having to look after themselves, I think, was sort of quite mind-blowing for them.
Did that dawn on them right away, like even on the day?
I don't know. I don't know. But I'm sure it could have come into their thinking. Anyway, Maharishi was quite clever. He said, why don't you come to India, where he has an ashram, and where they can grieve properly, have time on their own, away from the press and away from everybody except other meditators. And he was right, you know, it worked. It was a wonderful 2 months being spent, you know, in the foothills of the Himalayas. It's very calm and peaceful there. And, you know, of course, being musicians, they brought all their instruments with them, and where they wrote fabulous songs together. And most of the songs went on the White Album.
I really liked in your book where you had a picture of a birthday card that John had drawn for you, because I believe your birthday was celebrated in Rishikesh.
Sweet. Wasn't that so sweet? I know. It was lovely.
It's delightful that something like that still exists. I would imagine you have also some interesting memorabilia from that time of your life. Yeah.
Yes, I have a few things. I have a mad letter that John and Yoko wrote to George and me. It's so funny. It's in my new book, so when you get it, you'll see it. I do have, you know, bits of songs and bits of memorabilia. Of course, letters from George to me when he was on tour. And also one letter saying that, you know, how sad it was that the Beatles were actually definitely going to split up. So I think, you know, that was a hard pill to swallow, because everyone had got so used to the Beatles being together and being friends. And gradually it was becoming fragmented. They all wanted to go in different directions. But once you've made a decision to go in a different direction, it doesn't make it any easier, because, you know, for them, they had three others that they were reliant on and were reliant on them. Yeah. So it was, very difficult for them all. Although they knew, I think, that it had to happen eventually.
Well, we watched that moment in the Let It Be documentary where George walked out for a few days. What are your recollections? Was that one of the first times you've heard that defiant, "I'm leaving the Beatles," or did it come much earlier?
I can't remember. I think Ringo, in fact, was the first one who said he was leaving the Beatles. He was just fed up. He'd had enough. And George was so grumpy. And clearly, something was very wrong. You know, he wanted to leave, but he didn't want to leave. It was a tricky, very tricky time.
He was blooming into a songwriter, an artist of the stature of Lennon McCartney at that time. It must have been a frustrating position to be in.
Well, certainly. And the thing is also, I mean, Paul and John really only allowed George to have one of his songs on each album. And the frustration was huge for George because he loved writing songs and he had amassed quite a few. And so for them not to want to listen to everything, because they were so busy, you know, being creative and doing their songs together and individually and then joining them up together. Mm-hmm. You know, the creativity was very busy.
So when George left the film studio that day and came home, do you recall the conversations? Do you recall John or Paul coming over to talk George back into the band?
Well, we lived about 45 minutes out of London. So if they did, they would have had prepared for the long drive. I know that John and Yoko came over to talk to George about it. And I didn't really hear the conversation because I thought it was their business, you know, didn't want me around. You know, George had made up his mind, and he was quite strong in that way. Once he'd made up his mind, that was it. He didn't want to be persuaded to go back. But I think also John and Yoko really wanted to leave too, mm-hmm. you know, because they wanted to do their own thing.
Yeah. Did it seem frustrating at all for yourself, or maybe some of the other Beatle partners, that Yoko was attending recording sessions?
Well, it was rather irritating that she was the spoilt one and we weren't. But, you know, who wants to be left out? Not us. No one wants to be left out. But, you know, the thing is that I think at one time Yoko thought she was pregnant, so she wanted to be near John and, you know, I think she even had a bed in the studio. So she was, you know, being looked after. I, on the other hand, was very healthy, and nothing wrong with me, so I wasn't allowed in the studio.
Yeah, it seemed like there was this rule for a long time, then it became to be broken from this one exception.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
After the Beatles breakup, did George talk about missing being in the Beatles? Was it something that he was potentially keen to revisit at some point?
No, he wasn't at all. No. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in any way nostalgic for him. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, he loves George and Paul and Ringo individually, but I think as a band, as the Beatles, I think it had reached its zenith. It had reached as far as it would ever reach. And, you know, he didn't really want to talk about it because there's nothing to say. You know, you move on with life. Always. It's, you know, you can't just get stuck in your past. Mm-hmm. It's a bit sad to do that, really. Yeah. George was full of energy and music and very creative and wanted to, you know, move forward.
I read in your book where for the promotion of All Things Must Pass, you and George had gone to New York and met with Paul and Linda. And it seemed to me that in the course of conversation, it must have come up like, maybe we should do a song together or work together, you know, reconnecting at an artistic level. Do you recall witnessing any conversations or being part of those conversations?
Yes, I remember hearing that somebody had offered a vast amount of money in those days for the Beatles to play one more gig, one more show. And they were laughing about, oh, God, you could never get us together to play.
Okay, so they were digging in the heels.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was through, it was finished.
Right.
But I think for fans, you know, they couldn't believe it. They just thought, oh, to see them one more time. But, you know, if you think about it, and you must have seen a lot of old film footage of them playing at wherever they played. And as soon as they walk on the stage, the fans just scream like mad. Mm-hmm. And even when they're playing, they're still screaming. So it's no fun really for them on stage. No one can really hear them.
Yeah.
It was pure excitement and they couldn't help themselves. But I mean, they must look back and think, oh God, if we hadn't been screaming, we would have heard them properly. But they bought all the records anyway.
Well, by the mid-70s, sound systems were a lot better in live arenas anyway. So
yeah.
maybe there would have been a shot. Do you recall, I'm intrigued about this one-off gig they were offered. Do you recall anything else about that one show?
I don't remember who it was or where it was going to be. But it was, you know, it was vast for those days, as you can imagine. If the same thing happened today, it would be vast amount of money.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Did you and George have disguises when you went out in public?
We went on holiday with John and Yoko. No, sorry, not Yoko. John and Cynthia on a couple of occasions. And we all had different names for flights and for hotel bookings.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't know it was us.
Okay. Any physical disguises?
Well, I would. I would definitely have my dark black wig, which was fun to wear. And, you know, I could wander around freely and no one would know it was me.
Okay. George didn't have on a fake mustache and beard or anything. Well, actually, he had a real mustache and beard.
I think he did that occasionally, like a little mustache.
Mm-hmm. I was also very delighted to see in the new book that you have the original artwork for the Derek and the Dominoes album cover.
Do I?
The painting.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. The Layla painting. Yeah. I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me the story of that painting.
Well, this is when this happened when the Dominoes, Eric and the Dominoes, Eric and his band mm-hmm. went down to the south of France. I think they might have been mixing there or writing some more songs. Anyway, they stayed in a rented house. And in this house was a painting. Eric fell in love with it. And for some reason, he associated it with me. And he told the owner of the house how much he loved it. And may he buy it from them. And they said, well, yes, our father did this painting. And we want to give it to you. And very kindly, they gave it to Eric.
Mm.
Who, as far as I remember, gave it to George, who then gave it to me.
After the Layla album.
Yes. So I am the lucky owner of this painting. And in fact, the family of whose father painted Layla, they all know I have it.
Wow. Has he done any other work?
Yes, he has. Franston, he did. He's done quite a lot of work, similar kind of style. And his children have exhibitions of his work every so often, maybe once a year or once every 2 years in Valbonne in the south of France.
I know exactly where that's at. Sophia Antipolis.
Do you?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I almost moved there, but then I went to Australia. But yeah.
Where are you from originally?
California.
Oh, are you? And then you went to live in Australia via Valbonne?
Well, I was about to move to South France, Jean-Lapin, that area of France. And then I started dating an Australian woman, which took me the other direction.
Okay. All right.
So this book, My Life in Pictures, again, very, very delightful. And it seems to me that you have perhaps quite a bit of material, even for a subsequent book, should you choose.
I do, you know. I do. I've got so many photographs, and I kept saying to the editor, look, here's another bunch of photographs. And here's some more, you know, sending more photos over to him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being the editor, he knew what he wanted. I said, Dave, this is your book. It's not my book, because he made all the decisions. All I did was send him photographs and memorabilia, letters, etc. But, you know, there's so much more that my assistant and I thought it could be quite interesting to maybe do a talk and show all the photographs that were left out, like the B-side.
Yeah.
Like B-side. Mm-hmm. Photos that were left out, not because they're not interesting, it's because they didn't really fit in the way photographs are on the pages.
Right. Okay.
And so there's a lot more. I mean, I thought about it only today, actually, that maybe I could put out another book, called it The Ones That Didn't Make Number One, or The Ones That Didn't Make the First Book, or, you know, something. But I'd have to probably self-publish or, you know, ask somebody if they would like to help out with this. But it's a good idea, actually, I think.
Mm.
As interesting.
Yeah, it's really quite fascinating to be able to peer into that world. And again, this is, you see a lot of photographs that were made by photographers at the time and ones that you become accustomed to, but very rarely do you see them from the subjects themselves and their particular viewpoint, which I thought was particularly interesting.
Yes, yeah.
Now, a lot of what we do here on this podcast is we talk about records and we talk about collectibles and things like that. Do you have any records from the early days with George or Eric? Do you still have any of those records?
No, I don't. I don't know why, but all the records that I have from George, I took over to Eric's house when I lived there. Mm-hmm. And then when Eric and I split up, it was so sort of acrimonious, and I thought, well, I can't take the records because I couldn't, and I didn't. And so I've ended up with not actual physical records.
Okay.
It's a bit sad, I know. And also, see, I used to have the, you know, the white labels, the first pressing of a lot of the Beatles records. And there, you know, I left them all at Eric's. I should ask them for them back one day.
I think you should, because those are highly collectible and deserve to be in a museum somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. I might try and I might give him a little phone call and say, can I have them back after all?
So, Patty, again, it's an absolute honor to have you here on the show, and really appreciate you sharing some of those memories and talking about the books and the times with George and Eric. And the memorabilia. I do want to call people's attention to Patty's book, My Life in Pictures. It's available at pattyboyd.co.uk. She's also got another book, Wonderful Tonight or Wonderful Today, depending on where you're at in the world. And that is her autobiography. And again, a wonderful story and a lot of background, especially for us music nerds out there who like to hear the stories behind the record. And Patty, please, anytime you have a project or if you get those records back from Eric, you give us a call and let's have another conversation here on The Vinyl Guide.
You know, you will be the first person I'll call if I get them back. And we together can say a special thank you to Eric.
Yes, absolutely. Even pictures of those I'd love to be able to see. But yeah, absolutely. That would be appreciated. Okay, Patty.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks again. Have a wonderful day.
My pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye.
She's absolutely delightful. Check out her books, both of them, My Life in Pictures and Wonderful Tonight. Both are available wherever you get your books. They're signed copies at pattyboyd.co.uk. And just a reminder, if you enjoyed this conversation, there's an extended version up at patreon.com/vinylguide. You want to know what to get me for Christmas? Well, you can always help support the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. Episodes are up there early, they're commercial free, they're quite often extended, and they're always high resolution. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, post them to Facebook groups. different groups that you may think are relevant, like this one would be potentially Beatles or Eric Clapton or whatever. You know, if you belong to those Facebook groups, go ahead and share this link. Fellow fans will be grateful, and so will I. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.